just wanted to thank you very much for this opportunity, and just want to let you know Pam Walton is also joining us today, and she's the smart one of HR HotLink, and she's very helpful. Everybody knows her, and she's, you know, just right there to, you know, answer any questions and that you may have. Just want to let you know we're very supportive of what Adoma does, and any way we can help, please let us know. I know these last couple of years have been crazy, especially with COVID and that. And actually, we hadn't, last time we were going to have an in-person speaking opportunity, we ended up having to cancel because of COVID. Just want to let you know, I'm going to be sending out gift cards, well, actually e-gift cards to Starbucks to everyone. Just wish you a happy holidays and a safe one. And just feel free to give us a call anytime. Just a reminder, John Boggs will be speaking this next month. They'll be doing two seminars in person in the LA area and one in Sacramento. And he'll be talking about the new laws that are coming about for the car dealerships and that. And when, we do have a couple of new things that have come out, just to let you know. We've got work opportunity tax credits. What they work is basically any new applicant that qualifies, could be like if they had military experience or worked in a work opportunity tax zone, the average is about a $2,000 savings. So we'll be releasing information that, and that's something that will be on our system and that. So anyway, just Pam will be sending out a test email. We'll get some gift cards out to you for some Starbucks on us. And just wanted to thank you very much. And please let us know whatever we can do to help. That would be great. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, David. And Pam, I do have a list of all of the people that attended, so I can email you that so that you have everybody's email. That might make it a little easier for you to send out the Starbucks. Okay. With that being said, I also in the chat put the link for the holiday party if anybody needed it. But with that being said, we are going to turn this meeting over to Chris and Monica. Going to be talking about new laws in 2022. So here we go.
Thanks, Alin. Hi, everybody. Monica's here too, I believe. Monica?
Yep. Hi.
Awesome. So Monica, every year she does this. She's amazing. She scours the new legislation to see what's new and puts together a nice presentation for us. It's a publication that goes on our website and goes out in an e-blast to everybody that lays out what new law was passed, what the existing law was, how the new law changed, and some takeaways or action items for you. It's a real nice piece. It should be coming out shortly. I'm not sure if we have a date actually for it yet. Monica, do you know?
I'm guessing we'll probably have it out early next week.
Okay. So look for it early next week amidst making turkey and pie. And I guess with that, we can get started. That's us.
Yep. Yep. So we'll flash our contact information again after this. If you aren't currently signed up for our e-blasts, our email's here. You can contact either of us. We'd be happy to get you set up. We'll post, it's posted again at the end of the of our presentation. So if you're furiously writing it down now, you'll have another chance. All right, we're going to start with the new employment legislation. Just an important note with all of these laws, they go into effect on January 1st, unless we note specifically that it starts otherwise. And that's true for all of the laws that we're going to be going over. Probably the biggest change this year that's going to mean something you all have to do differently is a bill that impacts non-disparagement agreements. You may recall a couple of years ago in 2018, in the midst of the Me Too movement, there was California legislation that made it unenforceable to pass or to have settlement agreements with non-disparagement clauses that prevented employees from speaking about sexual harassment, discrimination, or retaliation. So really focusing on sexual harassment. What the new law does is this really broadens this area, that this protection. So now any provision in any agreement that's entered after January 1st of next year that prevents or restricts an employee from disclosing any factual information on any type of harassment, discrimination, or retaliation is banned. So the main point here is it's no longer just sexual harassment, workplace discrimination, those anything having to do with gender identity or sex harassment, that it's no longer limited to that. So if you have any kind of claims or a dispute with any of your employees that relates to racial issues, ethnicity, disability, to any number of those categories, that now you can no longer have a confidentiality and non-disparagement agreement that prevents the employee from providing factual information about that. So this is a really big change. If you currently have a severance agreement that you use when an employee leads under some sort of cloud, you need to change that severance agreement. Similarly, if in your new hire packets you have any information, any requirements of confidentiality, you need to include specific language about it that carves out these areas. In addition to, though, it goes even beyond the previous law that prevented employees from speaking about sex harassment to now covering any information that has to do with anything that the employee believes was unlawful conduct. So that's an even, so there's the expansion from sex to other kinds of discrimination, but now this also covers unlawful conduct. So in that case, it doesn't have to do with discrimination, but you cannot prevent employees from speaking about what they believe, and that's a key part here, that they have reason to believe is unlawful conduct. So that really is going to limit the value of non-disparagement and confidentiality agreements in the sense that if an employee either was harassed or discriminated against or believes that any conduct that they saw at the dealership was unlawful, you cannot prevent them from speaking about that. So as you can see here, you do need to act as a result. First of all, if you have new hire agreements, your new hire packet should, if it includes confidentiality or non-disparagement agreements, it should be reviewed by counsel before the beginning of the new year so that any new employees that you hire can sign an effective confidentiality or non-disparagement agreement.
Yeah, on that point, it's really important. It's really important that you have somebody look at that because this doesn't bar confidentiality agreements generally. And those are very important to have in the context of, you know, working with your employees because of things like customer lists and other things that you want to maintain as being confidential, but it has to have the appropriate, has to be updated to contain the appropriate language so that you don't run afoul of this law.
Yeah, and as Chris is saying, same thing applies to severance agreements. And just generally, it's really important that you understand these new limitations. I think that...
Yeah. One other quick thing there, Monica. Sorry to interrupt you, but somebody asked a question. Can we tell other dealers if the employee did wrong... Can we tell other dealers if the employee did wrong things? generally speaking, you... it's kind of a slippery slope because you have to also deal with things like defamation. And you never really want to be out there saying something bad about somebody, particularly if there's any particular subjective element to it. Whatever you say would have to be able to be proven if it shows the person in a false light. So it gets a little tricky. But if you have something specific in mind, you can ask us offline.
Yeah, This law doesn't really affect that decision per se. As Chris was saying, there are lots of other considerations to make here. This law doesn't mean that you can't say what a dealership can't say what they want to say. But as Chris is pointing out, there are issues that has to be true. There can't be any subjectivity. The difference between the dealership and, you know, that individual is that the dealership is a much deeper pocket. So while this law does not say that people can say false things about a dealership, you can still sue someone for defamation. But unlike a dealership, that individual person just generally doesn't have the money to make it worthwhile to go after them and start airing the dirty laundry. On the other hand, if a dealership feels like you've either restricted what they've said or said something, and what, like Chris is saying, if they feel like that you've disparaged them with false statements, the dealership is a good target for a lawsuit. So you just have to keep that in mind when trying to make those decisions. All right, the other really big law that requires some action here is AB 1033. There are two things here that are separated. This is a bill that was actually sponsored by the California Chamber of Commerce. First, it does what it considers cleanup, and previous law, of course, under the CFRA guarantees unpaid leave for employees who must take time away from work to care for a family member. That's the list of people that they can take time away from to care for did not include parents-in-law. So this law adds parents-in-law. That means that all your handbooks should be updated to include parents-in-law to reflect that employees are allowed to take time off to see them. If you did not have your employee handbook updated last year, there were updates to the CFRA last year. So this is a good opportunity to make sure that you're up to date with both last year's additions and this year's edition, so that you have a complete statement of what your employees are allowed to do in terms of taking unpaid time off to care for family members. The second big change in this, and this is probably why the chamber was interested in this law, next slide, Chris, is this mandatory mediation for small employers. Still under the same bill, but pretty separate provision. In 2020, there was law establishing kind of a pilot program for mediation for small employers that are size 5 to 19 employees. When an employee takes leave takes family leave, if there was a dispute related to that, the purpose of this was to send it to mediation. So basically, this law expanded these leave requirements to smaller employers, and then added a mediation approach as opposed to kind of keep litigation from getting out of hand. What AB 1033 does is it adds new procedural requirements, making it much more likely that a small employer can take advantage of this mediation program. First of all, make sure that the employer finds out about it. It requires DFEH to inform the employee of this requirement and establish that to initiate mediation that this is part of mediation and their right to sue notices. Go ahead, next slide. And then it clarifies that a small employer may stay civil litigation or arbitration proceedings in order to pursue this mediation process. Now, this may not apply to very many of you because it only applies to employers with 5 to 19 employers. But if you do have a smaller dealership, this may be something worth taking a look at to see if it applies to you. Particularly if you've gotten down to numbers recently. So basically, this is a good opportunity for you to see if you can take advantage of this program because it would be a much easier way, much less expensive approach to resolving issues relating to family medical leave. All right. So next really big change to law under employment law. I put this under employment law because I do think it most directly affects your employment relationships. As you may have noticed over the past year and a half with everything with COVID, Cal OSHA has been just a big part of all employers' lives. They're the ones who've been imposing most onerous COVID-19 restrictions. So SB 606 gives Cal OSHA additional new powers. And there are three big ones that I want to highlight here because you need to be aware of them. First one is it creates a rebuttable presumption that a violation committed by an employer that has multiple work sites is enterprise-wide if either that employer has a written policy or procedure that violates Cal OSHA regulations or the division finds that there are a pattern or practice of the same violation committed by the employer involving more than one work site. This is especially important for dealers because many of them have dealership groups. And so you may have the same policies and
She's gone.
She's gone. Let's see what happened there. I wonder if she knows she's gone.
How?
Let me just nudge her real quick. Okay. I'll just continue with this until she comes back. So that's the first effect. The bill would also impose other specified requirements for a stay of abatement pending appeal of an enterprise-wide citation. That's kind of getting into the weeds a little bit, but the biggest issue is the the enterprise-wide liability. You'd basically be subject to the same penalty provisions as willful or repeated violations. So that's nifty. That was sarcasm. The second effect is that the bill would require the division to issue a citation for an egregious violation as defined for each willful or egregious violation determined by the division. So the bill would require each instance of an employee exposed to that violation to be considered a separate violation for purposes of the issuance of fines and penalties. So that's wonderful. And here are the egregious violations as defined, which they're you know, sort of what you would expect, an intentional violation, a violation that resulted in worker fatalities or a catastrophic work site situation, or a large number of injuries and illnesses, a violation that resulted in persistently high worker injuries and illnesses, if the employer had an extensive history of prior violations, or intentionally disregarded the health and safety, their health and safety responsibilities, or if their conduct taken as a whole amounted to clear bad faith in the performance of their duties, or finally, the employer has committed a large number of violations so as to undermine significantly the effectiveness of any safety or health program that may be in place. So there you have it.
All right, I'm back. Sorry about that.
Okay, no worries. I finished the first effect and got into the second effect of this bill. We're on the third effect. I haven't started that if you want to pick it up.
All right, yeah. Sorry about that, everybody. A little bit of technical difficulties. So to get on to the third effect, the first two are the big ones, but the third one is that the bill grants the Cal OSHA new power to investigate policies of dealerships, not dealerships in particular, but businesses generally, and particularly that they can use the subpoena power in order to get prompt answers to their inquiries regarding both policies and practice at dealerships. They also have the power to institute conjunctive restraining orders that would prevent certain kinds of operations or practices by after a citation. The point of me raising these new powers is to just show you that Cal OSHA, after this period of time when it's been a big part of a lot of our lives, now has additional powers. It can go after dealers with multiple work sites, which again could impact dealers. It has the power to consider something egregious, which is, again, a new power to go after companies. And third, it has legal powers, including subpoenas and injunctive relief that it can use to get information quickly and to shut down a practice quickly. So this is all really important for you. One, because I think that large employers, particular dealership groups, should take some time to review any written policies that they have in place to make sure that they are in line with current Cal OSHA regulations. You could be deemed to have widespread violations if you have a written policy that isn't in compliance. And two, just be aware of these new powers and be prepared to respond to Cal OSHA subpoenas if necessary. If you ever do get a communication directed at you from Cal OSHA, contact your legal counsel immediately. It should not be something that's sat on, because as we pointed out, they do have new powers now, including those subpoena powers. And second, the ability to bring an action to enjoin your actions. So if you sit on something like that, you could end up with a court order ordering you to stop something pretty quickly. And my guess is that if you're not responding to a subpoena, that court order is going to be shut down the business. So just something to really pay attention to, make sure that you take note of that and act quickly if you ever do receive a letter directly from Cal OSHA. Great. All right. So hopefully this won't affect any of you, but one change to the law this year is that wage theft has now been turned into the crime of grand theft. So there's always been civil action for wage theft by employers. What this law does is it adds wage theft of any amount greater than $950 from one employee or $2,350 in total employees into the criminal code. So grand theft would it have to be intentional theft of this money. It's not going to be minor mistakes, but it does mean that in an area where there's been civil liability and you should be concerned for many, many reasons, now you can add to the list of concerns that the management of a company, if it knowingly violates these rules, could end up with a misdemeanor or a felony with up to 16 months or to 2 to 3 years of imprisonment. So it's a pretty serious change in the law, and really it highlights the importance of making sure that you're complying with wage and hour law.
What's really important about this is, you know, it's a penal code violation, which means that, you know, the person that's responsible for it is subject to this violation. So again, as Monica said, it's not, you know, it has to be intentional conduct, but, you know, to the extent that there's somebody that's actually in charge of paying everybody and they're not, and they're intentionally paying people incorrectly, they could be subject to a violation under the penal code, which would trigger criminal penalties.
All right, a little bit of good news to round out this section. If any of you have people who are working remotely, you probably notice how frustrating. You've likely been sending them notices online anyway. What this law does is basically any of the notices that you're required to post for employees, whether they're the annual wage and hour posters or most recently COVID rules in particular, those can now be sent to employees who don't work on site by email. In fact, this law allows you to send it to everybody. So this does not relieve the mandate that you also have to physically post those posters or any other notices that you're required to post, but it gives you a second option. And I would argue that you should take advantage of that whenever possible, just to have a second and provable method by which you informed your employees of any of these new requirements. And now the law blesses that as an approach. So in particular, as we're going into 2022, hopefully most of you work with a vendor who provides those big posters that you put up in the break room. Ask them for an electronic version of the 2022 posters. Then take the opportunity to send those to your employees. In that case, you'll have both comply with the law by posting it physically in the break room, and you'll have a record of having sent it out to everybody. Your vendors, with this new law, should be able to provide this to you. So take advantage of it and help create a record for yourself of compliance with these laws. All right.
Everybody's favorite subject.
Yep. You're probably all sick of this, and hopefully this will be the last year that we're going over new COVID laws. Let's get into what are the changes this year. The big one it's not a state law, but I couldn't miss the opportunity to put in front of you, but the big one this year will be the new federal vaccine mandate. Starting January 4th, 2022, employers with 100 or more employees must mandate that all employees who work on at a work site be fully vaccinated for COVID-19 or test negative for COVID at least once every 7 days. That's the basic rule. Let me break down a little bit more about that. So for purposes of 100 or more employees, that does include your part-time employees. So you don't get to, under at least the federal rules, you don't get to count part-time employees as half an employee, for example. You'll note that there's an exception for at a work site. So if you're thinking maybe you have 100 employees, but 10 of them work remotely, that still counts as 100 employees for the purpose of this mandate. The only exception is that the employee who does not report to work is not required to get to either be fully vaccinated or to test negative every 7 days. However, that employee, if they are going to report to work, does need to either be fully vaccinated or have a negative test result 7 days prior to their showing up at work. So just keep that in mind. If you have an employee who works off-site currently, doesn't interact with customers or your employees, works from home, if they're going to come in for the office, that does mean that they need to get tested. We have a great question right here. If multiple locations with common ownership totals 100, do all locations fall under this? My reading of the law is yes. There's a multi-pronged test that the federal government uses for this question, and the most important elements are common ownership and common management. So
speaking to the San Diego Dealers Association a couple weeks ago, and this question came up there too. And you know, there's a lot of different statutory schemes that consider all of your work sites together when determining whether you qualify for the provisions of the particular statute. And while it's not clear in any of the regs on this, it's most likely the case that it will all be all of your employees group wide would be included in the analysis and to determine whether this is triggered for you.
And I'll just add to that. When I was looking into this specific issue, the groups that are most actively litigating whether or not they have 100 employees, you know, the number of employees that they have for the purposes of these kinds of rules, in particular OSHA regulations, this comes from OSHA, are large corporations like Walmart is an active litigant in this area. And they usually lose in those cases because they have common ownership and common management. So in my opinion, unless you really want to go to the mat on it, when the Walmart attorneys are losing, I would take the more conservative approach on an issue if Walmart's attorneys are frequently losing on something. Great. I have another question here. Do we need to pay for the COVID test and the employee decides not to get vaccinated? Great question. Exactly what to talk about here. So we'll go back to the vaccination in a minute, but if you're going to allow your employees to test, then California, the federal law says that employees are not, nothing about the federal law requires that the employers pay for the test. However, under California law, basically anything that is required for someone to perform their job does need to be paid for by the employer, whether that's an item or the time it takes to do something. So in that, the federal regulation explicitly states that it does not, that local laws may apply here, which means that it's not trying to override state laws. I took that, and Chris and I analyzed this issue. We are of the opinion that means that in California, the safer approach is to pay for the tests because of California law, not the federal requirement. Chris, I don't know if you had anything you wanted to add to that.
I was just going to say, you know, and then there's also the time.
Right.
And, you know, they can take sick leave for that.
Yeah. So two things with the time. One, this regulation does require that you provide time to employees to go paid time off to go get vaccinated and to have reasonable time to recover from any symptoms from the vaccination. So keep that in mind. But secondarily, you may, if you set up a testing regimen where someone has to go out to another location off hours in order to obtain their testing, you, under California law, you're likely going to be required to pay for that as well. What I've been advising people is to right now start looking, if you're not going to mandate that every employee get vaccinated, that you start looking for tests now that you can administer on site. So you can, there are multiple FDA approved. You can find them on the FDA website. There are multiple FDA approved self-testing tests that allow people to either swab themselves and test at that moment and get results immediately. Those are approved for this mandate, or to send them off to another location. The benefit, though, of using those tests is that you can do it during work hours and not have to worry about paying for additional time off-site. So I highly recommend looking into those tests. It's probably one of the more economical options. However, you would also have the option of, at least in my county, there are multiple, I'm sure LA, same, San Bernardino, anywhere you may be located, that there are multiple locations for free testing. You can take advantage of those, but keep in mind, you are likely going to need to pay for the time that the employee takes to go get that test. So yeah, doing the self-administered is really advantageous.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you. Right. I was just saying that the administrative, how to administer that would be very difficult, I would think, unless you were just having them do it on site.
One last note about these tests, because this is a question we got last week. There are a couple at-home self-administered self-test tests that are approved. You may use those. However, under the federal regulations, that test must be either observed by the employer or a health proctor. So that means that if they do it on site, they should do it in front of a member of management. So you can just set up a time during the day, and unfortunately, probably one of you that'll have to sit there and watch it. But if you send the employee home with the test, one, keep in mind that you're going to have to pay for that time, and two, they need to be monitored while they do the test. The idea being that they don't want people gaming the system by having somebody else test it. So again, that's another reason why it's a really good idea to consider doing it on site during regular work hours, as opposed to sending people home with tests. One, you may have to end up paying for that time. And two, you're gonna have to find a way to monitor the test in order to be fully compliant. Let's just go back one slide though, Chris. I want to touch on a couple other things really quick.
Fully vaccinated?
Yes. So just to remind you all what fully vaccinated means, first, it means 2 weeks after the employee has completed the full vaccination regimen with an FDA-approved vaccination. So for Moderna and Pfizer, that means 2 weeks after the second shot. For the Johnson & Johnson, that means 2 weeks after the single shot in the dose. So just keep in mind that if you have employees who have not been tested yet, if they wait until, have not been vaccinated yet, if they wait until January 4th to start, they're going to have to get tested while they're waiting for to be fully vaccinated. Just keep that in mind. Second point I really wanted to raise is if you have already set up a procedure to have your employees tell you whether or not they're vaccinated, that's great. You can keep that in place. However, starting December 4th, the federal mandate is actually stricter than California on this point, which is a bit strange.
Did you mean January 4?
I'm sorry. Thank you. January 4. In California, if an employee attests to being vaccinated, you can take their word for it. Under the federal requirement, you actually have to get a copy of their vaccination record. There are multiple kinds of documents that are acceptable. So basically anything that comes from a doctor will be acceptable. The state has its own program where you can confirm your vaccination status and you get a QR code, one of those little boxes. I have that. I have my vaccination card. Either of those methods are fine. There's also a method where an employee can sign a statement saying that they're vaccinated, but they lost their proof of vaccination. That has specific language in it. Let us know if you need that specific language. But the important point here is, if you've not yet started gathering this information from your employees, then you're going to need to change your system. If For any employee that has already provided you with this information, you're in the clear. They're grandfathering in those systems. You do not need to go back and get information from employees who have already provided it to you. So this is another reason why starting earlier is better. You can gather that information now and not be subject to this rule. So we got a question here. So we should have a copy. Right now we just have them show it to us. Under current rules, that's acceptable. Starting January 4th, if you're asking anyone for their federal vaccination status, you actually need to get a copy and maintain a copy of their documents. That's correct. So that's a big change. What you've been doing prior was fine under California law, but now you'll need to make changes in the future in order to comply with the federal mandate. All right, let's go ahead and move forward. Two slides this time. Okay. And as I mentioned earlier, the other big mandate in this is consistent with current California law, but employers must offer employees paid time off in order to receive the vaccination and recover from symptoms related to vaccination. That's completely consistent with current California law. So you'd have to do that. You have to do that now, and you'll have to do that after January 4th. In all cases, if an employee needs to take time off to get vaccinated, you should give them paid time off to do that. Important news about this, just something to keep in mind, is that the regulation is currently stayed while the issue is being litigated through the federal court. The last court hearing on this was for more information. It's currently going through a conservative court. However, the U.S. Supreme Court has been pretty accepting of vaccination mandates. So I think it's unlikely that they're going to overturn this law. That's my opinion. But I tell you all this because I still think that you should be prepared for compliance on January 4, 1, and 2, you do need to watch the news on this. We will be publishing any information once it gets through the circuit court level. And then I assume it'll go to the Supreme Court at that point, and we'll, of course, be updating everyone on that as well. Action item here, employers really need to start working with their council now to establish their vaccination/testing policy and start communicating it to your employees. In my opinion, earlier communication is likely the better approach. If at all possible, you'd want as many employees to get vaccinated as can so that you can avoid the cost of doing the testing. You may also choose that it's your choice as a company, but you may choose as a company not to allow testing and to only require vaccination. If you want to go that route, I'd highly recommend giving your employees as much leeway as possible. Specifically, if possible, it'd be good to let them know immediately after the Thanksgiving holidays so that they have 1 month at that point to get fully vaccinated. So if you do that approach, do keep in mind it doesn't mean that you have to have full vaccination by January 4. You could set a policy that says all employees must be vaccinated by February 1. Testing will be accepted in that between now and then. But anyway around it, you need to make sure that you have a policy in place that's addressing these issues by January 4. All right. So going back to state laws, there's a new relief grant program that the legislature passed this year. It's a large chunk of money, $50 million for nonprofits and $2 billion, a little more than that, for small businesses in order to provide them with grants related to COVID if they were struggling there. Now, I don't think that this is going to impact very many dealerships, but it's worth looking into if you do feel like your dealership has been in particular adversely affected by COVID-19, you may be subject to this. The bill also would exclude from it excludes some grant allocations received by taxpayers, including businesses for grants funded for COVID. So you may be able to receive a refund on taxes paid last year. Chris and I are not tax attorneys, so we highly recommend that you discuss this with your accountant to determine if you're eligible, but it's really worth knowing that this may be something available to you and to see if you can take advantage of this, particularly if you received a PPP loan.
More importantly, we're not accountants.
Yes, right. On top of that, we don't do taxes. That's like the one thing we don't do. So, yeah, but we want you to be aware of that because it could mean money. And that's always worth at least asking the question. All right, a little bit of, we're having a little bit of good news here. So this law went into effect immediately. As you probably noticed, there were health orders flying around all over the place over the last like 18 months or so. Current law gives local governments and health departments broad authority to take broad actions to protect public health. But what's been really frustrating about this whole process, at least for me, is that I have to spend a lot of time looking for these health orders, figuring out where they are, where's the most updated version. So this law requires that any agency that is sending out these health orders, if you have this power, you have to create an email list for stakeholders to ensure that they can keep apprised of changes. So that means that effective as of October of this year, all your local counties, your local health departments, whoever is issuing local orders in your area, and in some cases, like if you're in Pasadena, they have their own local health department, then you should sign up for that. Whether that's the end of the COVID restrictions or future ones, you want to make sure that you are abreast of local health orders. The idea behind getting up for this is that you will have the information immediately. Too often I've found that people weren't informed about this, that there wasn't good communication. So take advantage of this and get yourself signed up for local health orders to keep up to date about what's going on. All right. So I brought up these bills just to show you that it's not all doom and gloom. There have been some good lessons learned from the pandemic. Here, you may have been aware that there was widespread fraud of the unemployment insurance program, particularly right after the pandemic. This is a bill that helps prevent fraudulent claims by requiring that Department of Corrections share who is actually in jail with the Department of Employment Development Department, so that uninsured claims aren't being paid out to people who are in jail. Beforehand, these agencies did not talk to each other, and there have been estimates that billions of dollars was paid out to fraudulent claims, largely relying on people who are, or often relying on people who are currently residing in jail. It's not an action item for any of you, but this can impact employers because they pay into this system, so it could increase the costs to employers. So I wanted to show you that there are some good lessons coming out of the pandemic. All right, the next slide, Chris. Similarly, the legislature has instructed EDD to prepare for the next recession. As you may, again, you might have been aware, it may have impacted some of your own family members. California did a terrible job of getting people qualified, and getting payments out to people at the beginning of the recession when everything shut down. So this is a bill that requires the agency to actually plan for the next recession. The idea being there will be another one in the future. So figuring out how to approve when there's a rush of claims, how to approve them quickly and get money out to people quickly, though hopefully avoiding fraud this whole time. So again, no action item required, but just wanted to show that we're starting to come out of it and that lessons are being learned, hopefully in ways that'll make things better for employers and employees in the future. All right, let's touch on some vehicle laws and what impacts you most directly. Not a whole lot in this area this year, but a couple changes in specialized areas that could impact your dealership. One, it has to do with trailers. So under current law, you have to have a Class C driver's license in order to tow a trailer that exceeds 10,000 pounds, but is less than 15,000. What this bill does is it expands this requirement to towing recreational vehicles, property, and human occupations. That's a mistype by me. And anything that humans can occupy. That's what I meant. So any trailer that is between 10 and 15,000 pounds that has humans, a house on it, so if it's a trailer that you live in, recreational vehicles, basically requires a Class C driver's license. Now, if in particular, if you sell a lot of trucks that people use for trailer pulls, I'd recommend that you take a look at this law and learn about it, just so you can be the best salespeople possible of these products so that your customers are aware of this new change in the law. So I write no action item, but just keep that in mind if that applies to you, that something for you to think about. Background on this. So we've had for several years now a road usage charge advisory committee. The idea is that it's looking into switching from funding our roads with a gas tax to funding it to a road usage charge, meaning that whether you have a guzzler car or you have an EV, you'd be taxed on how much time you actually spend driving on the road as opposed to the gas. The idea being here, as California moves away from combustible engines, sorry about the dog barking in the background, but as we move away from combustible engines and towards electric vehicles or other kinds of zero emission vehicles, we've been seeing that the amount that we collect in gas taxes is going down, even just because the vehicles are becoming more efficient. So they want to figure out a new way to replace that. And so they've been studying a road usage charge for many years. I think this bill is a real sign of a vote of confidence in this process. And so I'd suspect that in the next 10 years, we probably will make this shift. From my point of view, it's a really interesting question because there are a lot of privacy concerns in knowing how much people are using roads for. We have tracking devices in vehicles. Hard to know at this point, but it is something that I recommend that everyone just keep an eye on because it's the future for our cars, future of how they're sold. And it may be something that I would predict could end up being a little bit of a problem for dealers since they are the in-between between customers and the DMV in so many areas. All right, another bill that's just kind of a sign of the times. So basically, existing law allows for testing of autonomous vehicles, and existing law is also encouraging the use of zero emission vehicles. This bill would have, in its original form, would have prevented the sale to regular consumers of any kind of autonomous vehicle unless it was a zero emission vehicle. So there were modifications to this, and now in the final version, after January 1st, 2030, any autonomous vehicles sold in the state must be zero emission vehicles. So between now and then, if autonomous vehicles are approved and they are not zero emissions, they'll be allowed. But after January 1st, 2030, the vehicles must be zero emission vehicles if they're going to be autonomous. That's earlier than the governor's mandate of 2035 for all vehicles sold in the state of California to be zero emissions. So just it's a sign of where the state is trying to push. All right. And then another small change to law that has to do with another pilot program. Currently, there's law establishing the California Clean Truck, Bus, and Off-Road Vehicle Program and Equipment Technology Program. Oof, that's a mouthful. And basically, this extends it to peer-to-peer truck sharing platform demonstration, basically allowing for more activity under this program. I only raise this to, again, reiterate the point that this is the direction of the industry, moving more and more towards zero-emission products. So anytime I get in front of a dealer audience, I try to emphasize that this is the future and something that every business needs to be thinking about is zero emission vehicles become our mandate state. Right. Chris, want to move me to the next slide?
Done.
Okay. Here's a small change that you may get a question about. I just want to at least make you aware of it. So existing law allows for the existing law accepts state license plates from other states for off-highway motor vehicles. This law would change it to only allowing license plates for off-highway motor vehicles if the other state has reciprocity with California. So it narrows this who can drive off-road vehicles basically in the state of California to only people who are residents of California and have them licensed in California, or people who have them licensed in states that give reciprocity to California. Probably not a big deal again to many of you, but if you have off-road aspects of your dealership, then that's just something to keep in mind because this does change who can drive on California road or off California roads. Let me be more specific there. All right. I've named this section contracts, but it's kind of an interesting bunch of laws that are worth talking about. All right, let's move on to the first one. So this is a change to consumer warranties, but let me just start off by saying it does not apply to vehicle service warranties. But still, that's a carve out that CNCDA fought for, but still worth talking about because not all products you sell may be considered vehicle service warranties. But basically, product warranties fall under the Song-Beverly Consumer Warranty Act that governs service vehicles. It does govern service contracts. So it's a big deal for dealerships, this law. The Song-Beverly generally. What this would do is it makes some changes to the law to explicitly allow month-to-month or continue until canceled service contracts for other kinds of appliances and other kinds of services. But it restricts how those can be canceled and make sure that there are certain consumer protections in there. So the reason why this is important, it will not apply to your service contracts. So your vehicle service contract that you sell. Part of the reason is that it's excluded, but I think arguably also those are not either month to month or continue until canceled service contracts. But why don't we advance the slide? You may sell other kinds of contracts that are not vehicle service contracts that are month to month or continue until canceled. So what I'm thinking of, for example, is any kind of key replacement contract. If it's not funded on a set amount of time, if you sell any kind of service contract that provides a month to month or continues until canceled for repair of any other aspect of a vehicle, any product that's sold, you know, any accessory to the vehicle, it's really worth taking a step back and analyzing those contracts to see if this law applies to them. In particular, I'm thinking that because this law will require that there are new ways of canceling those contracts, that it may impact how dealerships are compensated for them. So just, it's really worth thinking about, and it's very similar to the next law that passed this year, which applies to automatic renewal programs. So the last one applied specifically to service warranties and contracts, so for repair of a product that someone buys. AB 390 applies far more broadly. Basically, it regulates automatic renewal offers and continuous service offers that businesses make to California consumers. So starting July 1st, 2022, so there's some time to get this ready. It changes the rules to basically give consumers new protections. So among those protections are that consumers need to receive notices before the automatic renewal period begins. If they receive a free gift or trial that leads them into the automatic renewal contract, they need to receive additional notice about that. So here, again, this doesn't really apply to, you know, the meat of what you do on a day-to-day basis. But I do think it'll impact things such as OnStar and similar programs, or maybe if you sell any vehicle security programs, it's either a automatically renewing program or if there's any kind of free gift or period that starts the program, there are new notice requirements. I think that this will matter most for dealerships because it could impact how they get compensated for selling these services. You may find that vendors start wanting to offer lower rates for any of these programs that you sell because consumers will be able to more easily cancel them. But just so keep in mind that this is out there and this will affect your programs. If you, on the other hand, are thinking about offering any kind of services or a program that renews month to month, whether that be oil changes, car washes, keep in mind these two laws and at least have somebody, you know, have competent counsel review them to make sure that you are complying with these new laws. Because starting next year, you will need to provide additional consumer protections with these kinds of automatically renewing programs. Whether that's something that has to do with servicing a vehicle, servicing an accessory that you sold with a vehicle, or just a service generally, whether it's, you know, a satellite radio, security, car washes, all of those programs are going to have additional consumer protections if they renew automatically or renew without any action by the consumer generally.
You know, Monica, you mentioned that it would apply to service contracts too for vehicles, but it does not apply to vehicle service.
Yeah, those are vehicle service contracts are specifically written out of this law. So that's right. One area you don't need to worry about.
Right. Okay. Another comment is, Monica, you looked at this one. Is this limited to consumer contracts or does it apply to B2B? Because a lot of the vendor contracts we review for our clients have, you know, automatic renewal provisions in them.
Chris, that is a great question. So the way that it's written is that it is for consumer. So I think that it's going to be hard to argue that it does apply to business to business. However, that said, do I think there's so many things that we sign up for, maybe even as individuals that we use as part of our business. So whether that's, signing up for an annual subscription to an online service that I use as part of my job, will I be able to?
Yeah, for example, you know, all the music service, music streaming services that, you know, where they do a monthly fee under a monthly contract to pipe in music at the dealership.
Right. And those are often under a single person's name as opposed to actually being under the dealership name, or maybe, you know, maybe you as a professional sign up for a newsletter that you pay for once a year. We can think of lots of these kinds of services where I think that will be a fuzzy line. Now, as a business, if you're offering these contracts, I think you need to look at that very carefully. If you are a business yourself who would like the protection of this, it may be worth asserting if you need to from time to time. Though I do think that'll be a bit of an uphill battle. I think it'll be an interesting question when it comes, if it's a business to business directly, like two business names contracting for a service, I think it'll be difficult to assert. Whether or not it'll help protect you though, if you are using a service for your business, I think you'll have a better chance of asserting these rights in those circumstances.
So the takeaway there is not to rely on this applying to you in a good way.
Yes.
But know that it will apply to you in a bad way.
Ding, ding, ding. That's exactly right. Yep. All right. I'm also going to just take this opportunity to remind you of a law that we discussed last year, and that's the Debt Collection Licensing Act. So just as a reminder from last year, this is a bill that will license and regulate debt collectors, applies to debt collection attorneys as well. It's going to be administered, actually, it became effective January 1st, 2020, but it does require licensing by January 1st, 2021. Move to the next slide. The reason why I wanted to raise this is that it has a very, very broad definition. It defines debt collector using identical language as the Rosenthal Fair Debt Collection Practices, but it basically means any person who in the ordinary course of business regularly on behalf of that person or others engages in debt collection. So what does regularly mean? What does ordinary course of business? These are open questions. We don't know how the department is going to apply these. I've checked their FAQs, you know, several times in the last several months. We've done legal research on this. It's kind of an open question. Well, what we've found though in our research is that regularly and in the ordinary course of business tends to mean something that is a normal part of your business. It takes up, you know, some substantial amount of time. For these reasons, I think that if you do minor debt collection, so for example, you maybe file three or four small claims, three or four times a year, you call a couple people a year to collect on, let's say, a bounce check, or if you're holding their contract, then you're probably not going to need to get a debt collector license. However, if you're regularly doing this, or you find that you are ending up administering, you're holding the debt on multiple car deals a year, or in particular, if you do any kind of buy here, pay here, then I would take the more cautious approach and explore getting a debt collector license. Now, one thing to note is you do need to have a bond in place. So it's not something that you can do, you know, in a single day. You have to go get that bond and get someone to approve it. So you'll need to plan a couple weeks to do that. And importantly, if anyone who applies for a debt collector license by December 31st of this year may continue to engage in debt collection practices into next year while their license is pending. But if you wait until January 1st to submit that license application, you have to cease debt collection practices until you receive the license. So this really requires like an individualized approach where you each look at what your own company is doing to figure out if you need to get a debt collector license. If you do a lot of debt collecting within your business office, then may also be worthwhile to consider using a licensed service to do this instead so that you're not required to get the license. If you're kind of in that gray area and thinking to yourself, boy, we do have a decent amount of bounce checks. We have a decent number of cases where we end up having to hold the contract because we didn't rescind a vehicle sale quickly enough, then it's probably worth considering working with a licensed debt collection group to do that work for you so that you are not required to go out and get a debt collector license. All right, moving on to data laws. Just a couple here. We had a relatively quiet year we have one big one from the feds, and then it's been relatively quiet at the state level. So I'm going to take this opportunity to tell you about the FTC's updates to their safeguards rule. You may know this as the privacy notices or Gramm-Leach-Bliley. This is all the same area of law. These are privacy notices. You probably interact with this in the form of privacy notices that you provide to your customers when they provide their credit applications. That's what this is. In addition to having to provide those privacy notices, the GLB requires that you safeguard customers' financial information that's used for credit decisions. What the FTC has done this year is, after multiple years of analyzing the issue, they published new rules that impose new obligations on businesses. Specifically, anyone that's considered a financial institution under this rule now is going to have to comply with the new versions by a year from now, basically. The law specifically says that's a year from publication in the Federal Register. As of this afternoon, they still had not published this in the Federal Register, so I do not have an exact date for compliance yet. We will be sending out an alert as soon as that is published so that you'll have the exact date for compliance. Another reason why you should email us if you don't already get our alerts is that we are on top of this and we'll make sure that you get that date and know when you need to comply. But this is a major change that dealers will need to act on. And in 2022, it's not something that you can do overnight. NADA estimates that it could cost each dealership over $100,000 each year to comply. And I think that last estimate I saw was nearly $200,000 in the first year. Now, keeping in mind, that was some advocacy work, so they were looking at the higher bounds for those costs. But that should, so don't take that as, oh boy, we're gonna have to spend that amount of money. But I want to raise that to show you how important, how onerous NADA thinks this is and how seriously they're taking it. I read a lot of the federal comments on this rule, and NADA was all over it because they know that this is going to be a really big deal for dealers in particular. So what does this rule require? Let's move to the next slide. It requires some pretty major changes. Current law requires that you implement reasonable measures to protect the data of your customers. They also require that you designate someone to be in charge of that program and that you have a written program in place. What this does is it formalizes that requirement, so you have to do a lot more. You have to have a lot
more. One thing you didn't mention, Monica, is the first thing, which is super important that people kind of forget, which is they have to create a written record of a risk assessment.
Yes. Yeah. So I think, yeah. Overall, just to go from the overall, yes, Chris, exactly right. You're going to have a lot more in writing. You're going to have a lot more specific measures in place, and you need to have, you're going to be a lot more accountability. So as Chris was saying, what do we mean by that specifically? First one is you have to have a written record of a risk assessment. So Chris and I are both certified corporate compliance professionals. And one of the first things that we learned in going through that training process is that a risk assessment is the key to figuring out and anything where you're trying to eliminate risk. First thing you want to know is what's the risk out there? What are my risks? Where are things safe? Where are things least safe? And so you assess what the problems are. What this rule requires is you have a written record of having done that. So it's not something that you can just wave your hands around and say, oh yeah, we definitely did that. They're going to require a written record of it. So that means that you really need to make sure that you go through that process and keep record of having done it so that you can, if there's, God forbid, ever a breach at your dealership of your consumer data, you can show to regulators and plaintiff's attorneys, you know, here it is, we did the thing that we were required to do. After you have a risk assessment in place, the FTC requires that you have a written safeguarding plan in place. That's been true for quite a while. But instead of it being just kind of a general requirement where you lay out what you do to protect your customers' data, it now requires that you address specific areas. Those include access controls. So that means do you have passwords in place? Do you have multi-factor authentication in place? You need to have assess your data inventory and how you classify data. What that really means is does your system is it capable of splitting sensitive data from consumers and data that doesn't require the same level of protection? You need to make sure that you have encryption of data. Specifically, I recommend that you have encryption when you're sending data back and forth. It's less important for dealers, but if you ever develop your own software or applications, you need to have processes in place to make sure that that is a secure process. Authentication throughout the system, procedures for disposal of information. If you do any kind of change, you have to have a process in place for managing that change, a process in place for testing, and then an incident response plan. So the big difference here is that previously, a lot of safeguards rule plans were just a little hand wavy and said, we use reasonable measures to protect your data in keeping with industry standards. And that was kind of fine just to have a statement like that in place. That will no longer cut it with these new rules. So by roughly this time next year, you'll need to have a written plan in place that addresses specific areas, not missing any of them. And if you don't implement, for example, encryption, let's say you decide the risk is too low, we're not going to implement encryption when we send data, you need to justify that in your safeguards plan and through your risk assessment. So this is just a lot more formalized process, and it's basically pointing towards areas where you need to have security measures in place. It'll be big red signs for regulators and plaintiff's attorneys if you don't have these in place. All right. In addition to all of this, previously, you did have to have a person who was in charge of your safeguards. Now you have to have a qualified person. So it's a bit higher of a standard. That's in the rules. You may hire an outside vendor to be your qualified person. When you're going through this plan, make sure that you talk to a competent counsel to make sure that you have the correct person in place. And then finally, that qualified person is required to make periodic reports the board of directors or the governing body of the company regarding the safeguards program. Why is this so important? This means that the FTC is trying to place more of the onerous of the responsibility on this on the ownership and management of a company. And so this is a big red flag to me, meaning thinking that they may go after owners and managers personally if these things are not in place.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing that's important, and we'll have a program out for everybody when this is in effect, but you're going to have to not just work with lawyers, you're going to have to work with a vendor, computer vendor or data vendor, because the vendor's got to handle a lot of the technical aspects, but the program itself needs to be vetted by a lawyer or some other kind of professional that knows this area, because what you're trying to do is limit liability to management and the owners. And in order to do that, you have to have a program in place, just like you would to comply with the DOJ reg on corporate compliance and ethics programs. So it's a very similar concept that they seem to be targeting. So that's why it's super important to have both of those aspects.
Yeah. Yeah. I cannot emphasize enough what Chris just said. I think that you're all likely to start getting inundated with solicitations from vendors saying that they can get you into compliance with the FTC safeguards rule. And maybe from a technical standpoint, they may be the best option for you. But keep in mind that when there's a lawsuit, what they're going to be looking for are these written policies, this written risk assessment, this written program, the proof of reports being made to your board or management. So to me, it seems very unlikely that you're going to find a vendor who can provide all of that. You'll need the technical assistance unless you have you have your own in-house team that's capable of doing this. You'll likely need the outside technical assistance to do it. But I think it's very unlikely that they're going to have legal issues in place to help you address this. So please,
they may say they do, like a lot of them.
Yeah,
but that's usually doesn't cut it.
So yeah, just please make sure that you talk to your attorney about this before you move forward with any vendor, particularly one who's making promises that they can get you fully in compliance with the FTC safeguards rule. Because at the end of the day, you really need to don't spend all this money and then fail to have like the documents in place to prove that you did it. Because that's what's going to be important if there's a lawsuit or an enforcement action. And let me just talk on that really quickly. The FTC has gone after dealerships when there have been data breaches. I've written about it. In most of those cases, they were pretty egregious. But nonetheless, I do think that this is going to be an area where we see more enforcement, particularly with their new rules in place. And at the very least, if there is a data breach at your dealership, it's likely that it's going to get out into the media. You are required by California law and basically all states to notify customers of the data breach. So you can't keep it quiet. So there will be media reporting about it. And you'll almost certainly, I think, get a letter from the FTC asking you to show that you are in compliance with the safeguard rule. And the ideal situation is that you call up your attorney and they say, oh yeah, we did all this. Here's document 1, 2, and 3. Here are the reports to the board that you made. Send it off. That's the ideal situation. If you don't have those things in place, that's when you're going to get a pretty serious investigation. Second issue to talk about is California is one of the only states in the country that under the California Consumer Privacy Act allows class actions for data breaches. In most states, you can, of course, sue somebody if you are injured by a data breach, but you have to prove how you're injured. Under California law, though, you can pursue pursue statutory penalties. That makes it much easier to bring these as class actions and makes them much more attractive as consumer cases. I'll note really quickly that the kind of that doesn't cover all information that you hold about a consumer. So those private right of actions apply to specific information, but it does apply to the information covered by the FTC safeguards rule. In particular, anything with a social security number, bank account numbers, ID numbers. So the information that you'll find on a credit report or in any document, any reports that you pull about a consumer and maintain for their creditworthiness, that's all covered by the FTC safeguards rule. And now this law creates, in my opinion, a roadmap for plaintiff's attorneys to prove that you did not do the right thing. If you don't have these elements in place, then you're going to be just a sitting duck for those lawsuits. And again, now they can be brought as a class action. So if it's 40,000 customers whose data is released, each of them can get up to $700. So you multiply 40,000 by 700, and we're talking really big numbers at that point. And then in addition, there'd be attorney's fees. So they'll almost certainly ask for this information of you because this is the kind of information that is subject to the private right of action. It gives just, in my opinion, a roadmap to people to sue car dealers in particular, because they're subject to this rule, to show that they were not compliant with what they're required to do to protect that consumer data. So I just can't emphasize enough that this is really important to have in place. We're developing a program to help work with our dealers. You'll probably get a lot of information from vendors. I know the NADA is also planning on putting out some advisory information, but you need to make sure that you are doing all this at your dealership and have it in place and ready to go. Because no data security program can be perfect. There are bad actors, there are bad employees. You need to be prepared just in case something bad does happen.
Also, NADA's program will be very good, and it should be detailed like a lot of their other programs they put out there. So it's really good to make sure you get a hold of that. But they're going to tell you the same thing I'm about to tell you, which is that's their program's geared at the federal level because that's how they operate. That's their orbit. But that you should consult your California lawyer, your local lawyer, wherever you're operating, on the local rules that change what they put out. And particularly in California, where we're really focused on this issue of privacy in our legislature, where you're going to have a lot of differences from the federal law.
All right. So then I've scared you all. Let's move on to one other small change in the law. Basically, I'll go through this one quickly. This now makes it a crime for a person to sell or to access stolen data. So why this is important for you, hopefully you're doing this, but you probably get offers on a regular basis, sorry about the dog, to buy lists of customer data. I've been telling people for a long time that that's not a good idea for multiple reasons. You probably don't have permission to contact them for solicitations. You just don't want to invite that kind of attention. This increases the reasons not to do that. Don't buy a data list unless you're absolutely sure of the source of that data. I wouldn't even do it with a signed contract with them stating that they're not that the data is not stolen. Well, now this law does require intentionality. You have to have a reason to know that the data was stolen. Nonetheless, don't mess with it. In most cases, it's not wise to market to people that have not given you permission to market to them. So avoid doing it. Rely on your own data lists or information that you get directly from your manufacturer. Don't buy lists from like random people who are soliciting you online. All right. So that's what we had to cover this year.
Wait, I have one more thing, Monica. We had a dialogue a little earlier, I think, regarding AB 51. And, you know, that was went into effect, and then there was an injunction, and then the Ninth Circuit recently ruled on limitations on AB 51's effectiveness. It's probably should have had it in the employment laws, but maybe it'd be good to give a quick update to folks.
Yeah. So AB 51 it's a law that passed in 2019. So it's been in place for a little while, starting in, I believe, January 1st of 2020. It purported to say that you could no longer mandate that employees, either current or new employees, sign an agreement waiving their arbitration rights and condition employment or any benefits of employment on their signing that. So that's gone through a lot of litigation in the last couple of weeks. That's really clarified the law. One, the Ninth Circuit found that AB 51 is not overridden by federal law. That was kind of the big hope here, is that the Ninth Circuit would find that the Federal Arbitration Act overrides this and does allow employers to require arbitration agreements. The Ninth Circuit said, no, that's not true. So at least for the next couple of years, it is likely the case that any arbitration agreement entered into after January 1st, 2020, it will be scrutinized to see whether or not the employee entered into it knowingly or willingly, basically that they had the ability to say no. There's also a recent case that looked at what constitutes saying no. That was surprisingly good, though, for employers, because in that case, it was a farm laborer who traveled up from Mexico, I do believe. And the facts of the case made it that it was difficult for him to say no to signing anything new for an employer. But the employer never said you're required to sign this arbitration agreement in order to be an employee. So the Ninth Circuit.
And there wasn't any language in the agreement like that.
Yeah. So the language, the agreement didn't say it, and the employer never said it. So what the Ninth Circuit found there was that the employer was, it was unreasonable for the employee to assume that they had to sign the arbitration agreement in order to work at that location. So the important point of all this is that it looks like this law is going to be in effect for several years, and at least until the U.S. Supreme Court reviews it. And we'll see when that can be a slow process. But it should be something that you're paying attention to now if you want to take advantage of an arbitration agreement. So what we're recommending to our clients is that they review, in particular, their new hire packets to see what people have been signing and make sure that there's no language in there that says that it's mandatory. Second, that they should review their onboarding process to ensure that they are not communicating to any of their employees that it's mandatory. And then third, if you have been having your employees sign agreements that are likely unenforceable in the state, you may want to consider asking them to sign new agreements waiving their right to arbitrate, that and working with counsel to make sure that those comply with the new case law to show that they were entered into willingly by both parties. There are lots of different ways to design that, but if you have any doubt that your arbitration agreement right now would be enforceable, it's probably worth the effort and the time to get that reviewed and fix that so that you can take advantage of, in particular, a class action waiver. Because once you have multiple employees getting together, it's very difficult to get out of those cases in an inexpensive manner if you cannot rely on an arbitration agreement with a class action waiver.
Monica, do you recall whether cert's been requested?
No, I don't recall. Though I do believe that their time would be soon. So if that's happened, I
think they still have a week.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that and update it. Also, before we go, just real quickly, these are just the laws we covered are just laws dealing with the legislation that's passed this year. They don't include, you know, what passed and that the governor signed on. They don't include laws that were passed and the governor vetoed.
Okay.
They don't include bills that are still caught in committee and are going to be considered for next year. Those are all interesting things to hear about, but they don't impact your business, so we don't waste time dealing with them. Maybe the CNCDA will cover some of that stuff. I think they usually do. So it's just interesting table dressing.
That's
no immediate impact. But the other thing is that's really important is in January, we're going to put out a publication, which we do every year, that will not only cover, you know, it supplements this publication in the sense that this is all the legislation, but the January ahead of the curve will also cover all of the cases and all of the case law that developed over the past year that affects your business or the way you need to go about doing things.
You know, well, I'm going to take like 3 more minutes. One thing I didn't include here is what Chris is talking about, a bill that has not passed out of the legislature so far. And I believe that CNCDA will continue to try to push next year. And that's a bill that would make it clearly legal under California law to use e-contracting or electronic contracts for car sales. It's a very complicated issue, but California law says that it does not allow for e-contracting of car sales or leases, but federal law almost certainly overrides that. No one has fully litigated that issue, though. So as of right now, it's kind of a gray area. More and more of our clients, though, are moving to e-contracting. And I have to tell you that we're seeing more and more consumer claims that include an allegation that the dealership used illegal e-contracting. So this is not to blame CNCDA or anything, but I've even seen claims where they cite the fact that CNCDA is trying to change this law as evidence that it's illegal in California. Now, I think
which is not the import of that. I mean, the CNCDA is doing a really good job of protecting the dealers, and the whole point of this is to create a clarity where none exists now.
Yes.
But you know, the problem here really is the creative plaintiffs' lawyers and how difficult they can be.
Yeah. So I just wanted to raise that because I'm starting to see it a little bit more. And it is, you know, I think that the dealer would ultimately win that case if they decided to fully litigate it. It's hard to be that guinea pig. But the reason I raise it is just to make sure that if you are using e-contracting, make sure that your salespeople are doing it in an above board ethical manner, giving your customers as much opportunity as they like to review those contracts. I think that the cases that are most likely to be more problematic are ones where if a customer is rushed, doesn't get to have control over the screen. Let's say, you know, it's only on the desktop of the sales staff. If you are currently trying to e-contract through that method, that might be a concern. And since these cases are starting to pick up some speed, it's time to really review those practices and make sure you're doing it in a manner that's beneficial to the consumer. All right. Well, that's what we had for you today. Thank you so much for your time. If you do have questions, both of our emails are on the screen. Feel free to reach out to either of us. If you're not currently receiving any of our alerts or our publications, including Ahead of the Curve or Coffee Break, please do feel free to email us because we'd be happy to get you on that list. And I see there's only five minutes left, so I will be quiet. Glenn, thanks for having us.
Thank you both very much. I don't see any questions. Well, the only question I did see was, can we get this handout?
Sure.
Okay, sure. So you'll email it to me or you want to email it to them directly?
We'd love it as if you would email us or give us your email so we can get you on our list and you can get all of our wonderful information.
I did send you all the list of everybody that signed up for this.
All right. We'll make sure that everyone that signed up is on our emailing list then.
Okay. I sent it to both of you and to Jamie.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everyone, for your attention.
Thank you.